The EMS Educast is a podcast by and for EMS educators. Every week, our panel of education experts hosts a program that brings you the latest and greatest in EMS education technology, methods, and techniques. Your hosts will regularly bring you guests from all over the world to tell you about innovative EMS education programs and experiences in other places. Join us each week for the EMS Educast. And visit www.emseducast.com to subscribe with iTunes or the RSS feed, listen to archived shows, and view future show descriptions. The EMS Educast.
This episode of the EMS Educast is sponsored by EMS Manager. Visit emsmanager.net for a free trial of this innovative and easy-to-use EMS employee scheduling and management software.
This is quite possibly the most exciting moment of the week for me. Something I always look forward to is the chance to speak with Bill and Rob. This is Greg Fries. So glad to have you back for another episode of the EMS Educast, where we talk about EMS education. It's the podcast by and for EMS educators, but I suppose you know that from just listening to the introduction. Rob, hello.
Hello, Greg. How are you?
I'm well. I think I'm burning the candle at both ends right now between work and family, and I'm right at the peak of a marathon training cycle, getting ready for a spring marathon, and zoinks, I'm not sure how I get it all done.
I give up the exercise.
You give up the exercise.
Yeah, it's overrated.
See, that's the part that I think I'm sort of at the point right now where I'm like addicted to the exercise. And
yeah. I spoke to your family. They tell me you run too much.
Yeah, you know, Wednesdays are the day, like my day off from exercise. And for listeners, we generally record on Wednesdays. But sometimes it's tough to be like, oh, I should be quite right.
January through December is my time off from exercise.
I don't know. You might consider adding in July.
Okay.
July.
Maybe.
Bill, how are you?
I always enjoy listening to Rob and his things about exercise. Remember, we need to be role models.
Right, Rob.
Right.
Did you hear that part, Rob? Role models?
Right. Role. I've got the role part.
And like
the model part.
And just like you folks, very busy. Still, our big project we're doing here at work is concentrating on the training with the new Philips MRX monitors, and we'll continue that through mid-April, trying to get everything ready for a May 1st deployment of everything. So that really consumes a lot of our time right now. So that's my busy at work type stuff is getting everything, and then for some reason they still expect us to do everything else too. So that's just the excitement. So
well, there's no shortage of things going on. You know, related to exercise, David Blevins in I think maybe the first episode of the EMS Educast Mini talked about fitness during paramedic training, and I just sent David an article, and I'll try to put it in the show notes about a technical college here in Wisconsin, and they're going out to bid to build a new paramedic and law enforcement training center building or something on their campus. And one of the components of that building will be an actual area for the paramedic and law enforcement students to do physical fitness training every day. And I thought that was pretty interesting that not only do they say they're going to do it, but they're actually going to dedicate space in their student training area for that. So, I think role modeling and continuing advocacy, Bill, sooner or later, you and I will get Rob moving.
Well, I certainly hope so, because the weather being as challenging as it was, I went out and got myself a bike trainer, so I have no excuse even on snowy days or anything not to get on the bike and do some tootling when I can't get out and run or use the bike for real. So continuing to push things along.
Excellent. Well,
Clark, you don't believe in this stuff, do you?
Well, it sounds good if I say exercise, but by my pant size, I wouldn't be on the same page.
Well, there's always different size pants, so we can all be a work in progress, right? But listeners, we do actually have a guest. His name is Clark Imus. Clark, we're really glad to have you on the EMS Educast. In a bit, we're going to be turning the microphone around and letting you ask us questions. But before we do that, we want to get to know you. You know, who are you? What do you do? How'd you get into EMS? You know, at what point did you decide to become an educator? That sort of thing. So give us the full details on Clark Imus.
Sure thing, Greg. Well, first, thanks for having me on the show. I've been a longtime fan, and I'm glad to be on. About me, my career started back when I was in high school. I was took part of a career technology VOTEC experience, did some visits over there, and seemed to kind of really like the activities of EMS and the kind of the atmosphere that was there. So I got myself started there. Went there, was a first-year student, came back again as a second-year student. I wasn't able to test for my license because I wasn't old enough at the time. When I turned 18, tested for my EMT basic license right away, and went ahead and got that. Shortly after that, I went ahead and got a job working for Van Buren EMS out of Paw, Michigan. I was employed there for about 8 years, working as an EMT and then as a paramedic. Went ahead and got my paramedic training with Kellogg Community College over in Battle Creek, Michigan, back in 2004-2005, and really seemed to like it. Had some really good equipment, some really nice simulation equipment, kind of really got into it. Had a good group of people there, and went ahead and got my license, finished up my school there. Was nominated for EMS Student of the Year, which was kind of cool. So after that, got my license and started to work for a little bit and found that I wanted to get more experience yet. So I went ahead and went back to school to get my critical care paramedic certificate. Went ahead and did that. Continued to work on the road up until just a couple months ago. We ended up moving to Jackson, Michigan, where I took a job as the EMS director for Jackson Community College. After I got my paramedic license, I went ahead and got passed up on a couple of new job opportunities. So I realized that degree was probably pretty important. Went ahead and went back to school part-time, got my associate's degree, then went ahead and transferred on to a university and got my bachelor's degree in applied science and EMS. So that's kind of where I'm at right now.
That's great. That's a nice steady progression.
Yeah, I've been trying to do that pretty good, trying to keep a good motivation going here. I'm looking to go back to school probably in a couple years or so, year or two, and get my master's degree.
Wow, good for you.
And what do you see as your long-term goal, if you were to say, and let's just keep it, we won't get too long, but let's say your 3- and your 5-year goal?
That's a good question. Right now, I'm not 100%, I'm not 100% sure. I think my short-term goal is to get our paramedic program accredited. That's kind of been the most recent challenge. And then I would say probably long-term would be 5 years to have a master's degree in higher education.
Well, that's good. The accreditation process will be a wonderful learning opportunity for yourself. And what I would recommend is keep the end goal in mind. And don't focus on the always remember the end goal in mind, and it will be worth all the effort.
Well, that's the main thing, is if I don't focus on the goal, I won't get it all done. But I think that's a good piece of advice.
Clark, just I sort of blanked out there for a moment. What was the kind of – when was it that you finished paramedic school? What year?
2005.
Okay. So you've been at it 8 years in the business already, so – in EMS, that's quite a long time, actually.
Yeah, I think part of the reason I got into education was because I've seen a lot of the new people coming out of school from kind of the fly-by-night programs we had in our area. And the education was par, to say least. But that kind of drove me to get interested and to start helping. And, you know, when we had third riders in the ambulance, take the time to make sure they had a good experience, got something out of it. And that kind of snowballed into becoming an instructor.
Okay. Well, so the premise of the show tonight is that that you'll ask us some questions that I think we first connected by email, and you asked if we ever thought about doing a show of sort of like tips and advice and answering questions from relatively new educators. And I said, sure, come on the show and ask us some questions. And so this is your chance. I know you've prepared some questions, and you know, maybe some of them each of us will answer, or maybe others it will just be put to Rob or to Bill or myself, or somehow we'll make our way through your list. So why don't you get started?
All right. I guess my first question has to do with different course materials, different subject matters. Question is, what are the ways a new EMS instructor can present drier material with a new and interesting twist? Things like med legal, documentation, acid-base balance. How do you guys seem to tackle those challenging subject areas that can be a little bit hard to keep the attention of your students?
Wait a minute. You did... Greg, you didn't warn us these were going to be difficult questions.
Rob, just like exercise, there is some effort involved.
Do we have to give them the correct answer?
Let's try to be helpful, not only for Clark, but other listeners who might have the same question, you jokers.
This will be the lowest form of evidence. It'll be opinion-based.
That's fine. I'm actually preparing data while you guys share your opinions.
Oh. Passing the buck already. Holy doodle. Okay, I'll try to take this on. How do you make a dry subject palatable? Well, I think first and foremost, as a new educator, you have to lesson plan. And this is something I did when I first started teaching. I took a teaching and training of the adults program, and I learned about putting together lesson plans, which is essentially establishing a schedule of topics you're going to cover, activities during those topics, either is it lecture or is it student activities, equipment you're going to need, including manipulatives and audiovisual equipment, etc. And I don't do that so much anymore, but I think when you're first starting, especially with dry and difficult topics, it's really valuable to create lesson plans, because it puts you in a frame of mind to think about how you can make this more interesting, how you can create group work, have people using manipulatives, or how to put it into context with something else. So arterial blood gas is an example. I try to tie it in with the concept of ventilation versus oxygenation, so that they get a really good understanding of how blood pH, for example, affects hemoglobin's affinity for oxygen, like a very strong magnet in an alkaline environment, like a weak magnet in an acidotic environment. And I think you can get a lot of ideas from other educators. So, like coming on the show and asking Greg and Bill and myself, what can you do to spice up those dry topics? I think probably some of the greatest learning experience I've had is just talking to my peers, talking to my colleagues who teach, and getting ideas from them, because there's a big pool of us out there. So that's the extent of my pearls of wisdom. And now on to you, Bill, since Greg is doing research data.
I'm working on evidence.
This topic.
Well, I would, you know, the thing that I think that is very important, everything that Rob said is good. There is a, I'm going to ask you a question. Are you a member of the National Association of EMS Educators?
I am.
And have you been listening to their recent webinar series that they've had?
I have not.
Okay, I think you'll find them very valuable, because they're talking very much about the benefit of lesson plans and how they can really help you plan well your program. And I think as a beginning instructor, doing the lesson planning that they mention to the detail and the level that is brought out is very valuable. You'll find as you get more and more experience that you don't need as quite a detailed of a lesson plan to help you with your course, but it will make sure that you cover within that time frame that you set aside, whether it be a 25-minute chunk, a 15-minute chunk, an hour, that you cover the salient things that you want to do. And if time permits and the students seem appropriate, then you can enrich it beyond that, because you'll find that your time management will be a big deal for you, and you need to make sure that you keep that information. You really want to make sure that you stay focused on the material that you want to present in that time frame, and avoid your tangents. The other thing to do is I believe you need to read a great deal before you present the subject. And don't get me wrong, that doesn't mean you should have any fear about saying, that's a good question, I don't know, and I'll get back to you. Always remember that's the important thing to do there is that. But I think being very, very well read and looking for the latest articles on the topic that you're doing is essential. The other thing that works sometimes also is taking the time to go out and hear someone else do the presentation. You know, that also is a very good way to make sure that you hear someone give a subject, that you learn something about it from someone else, and then you can get an idea about what works and what doesn't work, and particularly if they present a good way. And then the last thing I would add to you is activities. You should think about really chunking it up. You may want to talk about only one concept, maybe emergency driving, or tort. You know, so you can define what tort is, but then you need to give an example that relates to what they're doing, and it needs to relate where they are in the development of their program, because you may want to introduce very early in the program when you're covering that section, let's say tort by definition and a simple example, but the thing that will be value is to repeat it later when they have a better understanding from their experience and gain. Excuse me, I had to sneeze, didn't want to do it over the air. Then you want to not embellish it, but get it back into it in more details later in the program when they have a better fundamental understanding, and you could give them more tangent examples. So that's something with a dry subject that I would talk about. Have a good lesson plan. Make sure you have good examples. Consider repeating it more than once and see someone else present that difficult topic and see if you can learn from them how to present it within your program.
I've got just a couple thoughts on this one as well. One is just to start out with how you frame it, that if your mindset is this is dry or this is boring, and then even worse, if you tell the students, like, this is really dry, we just have to suffer through this together, you know, that puts everybody into the wrong mindset. You know, it's sort of like juggling or magic tricks. It's not so much that they're very complex, it's the actual presentation that really sells it, you know. So start with just how you might frame it. The other thing I think that happens is the students either think that either they already know it, they learned about it in EMT school, all they need to know about, say, medical legal, or they don't actually need to know it, say, like acid-base balances. So, you know, flip the class around and say, you know, we're going to start this section with a test, because then you either challenge them to demonstrate that they know it, or that you put some pressure on them to figure it out, whether it be doing the classroom reading, going onto YouTube and trying to find a video about the topic and somehow learning about it. And then I would just quickly add that episode 34 is about games and education with John Dillon. Show Me Ideas for EMS Education, episode 144 with Janet Taylor. And then Teaching Tips for the Tough Stuff, episode 77 with Bradley Dean, all address this sort of like, how do we take something that either us and the students consider mundane and maybe present it or package it in a different way. And I'll put those links in the show notes. So great first question.
And I would just add, if you find yourself doing a lecture, you want to check in with your class every maybe 10 slides. So incorporate that formative evaluation. So knock off a small chunk and then ask questions. Then go on to the next chunk and ask questions. So you're checking in with them a little more formally than asking simply Does anyone have any questions? Anyone not understand? You know, that you're actually formulating some questions based on the material you've just covered, and you're not droning on for an hour at a time.
My next question is, how does an instructor navigate a classroom with young adults, the newer generation coming right from high school, older adults returning from a different career choice? How do you manage their different learning styles, different reading abilities, their technology experience and study habits?
I guess I'll start with that one too. Well, I think technology is an inevitable part of the industry that we work in, and it's going to be an increasingly significant part of everything that we do. So I think whether they're millennials or whether they're boomers, I think we need to incorporate technology into our classroom wherever and whenever possible so that they become, they achieve some sort of digital literacy. Because I find even some of the young students coming into to our program have technophobias, and other than, you know, simply using a smartphone, have no other function for it than perhaps listening to music or watching videos and maybe occasionally surfing the net. But, you know, will tell you, well, I don't want to try this technology stuff, and I don't like ePCRs, and I don't like these complicated cardiac monitors. Well, this is the industry we're entering. So I think it's important to incorporate electronics very early on in the program. So, for example, when you're doing case-based studies, have the students look up drugs on a drug app, regardless of the type of operating system that they use. So maybe establish in the very beginning that that they all download some sort of drug app, some sort of hazardous app. Maybe make a list for them, and maybe even challenge them to come up with free apps or good apps that they can talk about with their peers or share with you as the instructor. And, you know, much like incorporating formative assessment in your class, try to incorporate the use of technology on a regular basis throughout your class so that they're not tuning out texting or surfing YouTube while you're in the middle of class. You've actually got them actively searching for things. They're doing Google searches. They're doing PubMed searches. They're doing drug searches on their apps. They're getting that involved. So whether they're 19 or whether they're 56, they're all using the technology.
Rob, let me ask you, how do you guys use social media and how do you incorporate into that into your program? Because a lot of the problems that we have had is there's individuals who are very biased against social media and don't feel that it's part of it. But at the same time, I've seen it where an entire class uses it and uses it to grow and develop and to post and share ideas and things like that. How do you feel? Can we engage those folks who are anti-social media?
Well, I think Greg's probably better qualified than me to answer that question, because I don't actively use social media with my students other than to tell them a little bit about what some of the benefits of Twitter and some of the benefits of some of the other social medias. But what I do encourage and what my students tend to do anyway, even if I didn't say anything to them, is to create their own Facebook group where they can share information, they can teach each other, they can notify each other when there's an upcoming event that's maybe of interest to all of them as paramedic students. So it could be ground rounds at the hospital, it could be a webinar that's coming up, or sharing a link to a YouTube video that's relevant to our discussion today on excited delirium. It's forming kind of a social study group, if you will, through social media that gives them that informal place to learn from one another. So, but Greg, you're more qualified than I am for when it comes to incorporating social media into education.
Yeah, so this is probably linked as well the previous question about the sort of multi-generational nature of the student body. And you know, I, at least for a while, and I think it probably still is, like the fastest growing demographic as far as like Facebook concerned was, you know, adults over 40, or, you know, basically like my mom and my grandmother, or my mom or my kid's grandmother. So those older adults do sometimes find that sort of technology. As far as like the role it can play in the classroom, You know, I would circle back first to sort of what are the objectives that are trying to be met in either for a certain topic or activity, and then how do we best meet those objectives? And so if an objective might best be met by everybody find an example of this online or research a medication using an app that's a drug guide, or we're going to put some placards up on the big screen and we want you to use the ERG on your phone to navigate this. Certainly that makes sense. And I think Rob mentioned it too, clearly this is a technology people are expected to use in the workforce. And then Bill's talked a lot about just how the importance of us role modeling these good behaviors. I think, my final thought on this is just setting up guardrails for students of this is what's going to be acceptable in the classroom. This is what's going to be acceptable in the workplace. You're going to have to navigate some of this on your own. I don't feel like I'm doing an especially great job answering this question. So,
No, but you know what, Greg, you make a really good point that ties in with digital literacy. And sorry, I want to get Bill in here too, but and that is talking to the students about the potential risks of social media. And I don't like to be the old guy at the front of the class lecturing to them about, hey, you put that on Facebook, you're going to be held in custody for several hours when you try to get through the airport security. But they need to know that everything that they do from this point forward, they are ambassadors of the profession, and what they do is a reflection on the profession. And there are certain behaviors that if they were acceptable to them in the past, are no longer to be acceptable. And those would include things like, criticizing your classmates, your teachers, paramedics you run into in the field on social media platforms like Facebook. They need to know that certain photos on Facebook could have some serious, could become a serious impediment to gaining employment after graduation. So I think we do need to talk about digital literacy with our students so they know what's acceptable, especially, most of the social media platforms, which are U.S.-based, which are subject to the U.S. Patriot Act, and which is very different from the laws here in Canada. And I have to emphasize this with my students that, there are certain keywords and phrases on social media that could result in you landing in an interview room at the airport and not getting to your destination on time, simply because you've made a comment or put a photo on a social media platform that's not deemed appropriate.
And let me touch into here a little bit is that I like some of the stuff that Greg talked about. I think the concept of modeling is a good thing, but Rob brought up another good thing. You have to engage in the dialogue. And I think when you look at literacy, I think you need to look at, okay, just a simple survey. Know how many people have a computer at home, have a smartphone, know something about the class group, and then have them rate their sense of how comfortable they feel with each of their different platforms. I think you need to have some basic thing. And if you decide in your course, for example, that you're going to expect students to write papers, they all have some basic knowledge of a word processing program and stuff. So there's actually some tools online, and I can't think of one right now off the top of my head, but I've taken some college classes where you go online and you self-evaluate your competency in word processing as Excel, PowerPoint, and then the teacher has the ability then to design, know what everyone's level's at, then knows how to tailor the assignments based upon the and I hate to use the term least common denominator since we're not teaching them an IT class, but at least okay, everyone should be able to use a word processor in that. The next part is to have make sure this what the school's college university's policy is on social media and any restrictions that exist within the school structure towards how you can use it in the classroom or not. And then just, I think you can go out now and you can search some of a number of the trade journals and find examples of where people currently have gotten into trouble with their social media, you know, their smartphones, taking pictures at scene, posting, ranting and raving online. There was a real recent one just in Twitter about the son of the commissioner of the New York City Fire Department, who was a fire department EMT. He ended up resigning, and he's now taken his whole career there. And you know, by what his remarks were, and regardless of apologizing, the damage he did was done. So I think you need to show them, you need to show them that information there, and that comes by researching the current literature. And I'm not talking about just literature that deals with technical stuff, but here, social media. And then I think that you model it by how you use social media to advertise your program, to use Twitter or anything along those lines, and that you make sure that it's appropriate. And the final thing I can tell you, as an employer, which is my primary job right now, yes, we look, depending on the type of job that people are applying for, looking at their Facebook page or their social media page, can, and I can say only can, or I should say might, affect employment opportunities for particularly job-sensitive things. And I'll give you an example. This was given by our HR attorney, and he said, if, for example, someone who's applying for a clerical position, if their website, if their social media page is full of things that show, you know, they seem to party a lot, they drink, and there's pictures of them drunk at a party with people drawing on their face, probably, you know, not great, but should that be a reason to prevent someone from being in a clerical position that's doing filing versus someone in a job-sensitive position such as a paramedic that has access to narcotics and, you know, some other strong stuff? Would that make this person suitable with this kind of behavior? So students need to understand, I think, they're getting a job interview every single day that they're in class and every clinical experience they're going to, along with how they present themselves to what they think is social media. And the final thing is once it's on the internet, it's on the internet.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Hey, guys. I've just two things I'm going to interrupt here. First, relevant episodes, The Expectation is Clear Expectations about millennials and generational stuff. And then The Better Way to Teach Ethics, the episode we did with Bill Rayanovich, was heavy on this piece. I want to take a quick break to hear from our sponsor.
This episode of the EMS Educast is sponsored by EMS Manager. You have to try this software for yourself. It takes the chore of employee scheduling and management of EMS providers and makes it easy to set up, easy to maintain, and easy to manage. And with a mobile web app, accessible from smartphones and other mobile devices, an easy-to-use web interface viewable from anywhere on the World Wide Web, managers and staff can oversee, manage, and make requests or changes to employee scheduling from anywhere. Pricing is based on the size of your organization, so it's always affordable, and because it's web-based, your employee schedule and software is located in the cloud. This means there are no additional local IT costs to worry about, and there's always free training, free tech support, and free system software updates. If you want this for your system, check out the free customizable trial of EMS Manager at emsmanager.net. I want to thank EMS Manager for sponsoring the EMS Educast, as well as many of your favorite EMS programs from the ProMed Network. EMS Manager is proud to support EMS providers and managers through this sponsorship and to support what we do. Show your support for them. Take a few minutes to check out the free trial at emsmanager.net. That's AlladTech's EMS Manager for online employee scheduling and workforce management. Visit emsmanager.net for your free customized trial of this amazing employee scheduling and management tool. emsmanager.net.
All right, we're back. Rob, you were going to jump in with something quick, and then we got to get another question from Clark.
Yeah, I was just going to add something on a positive note with social media, and that is this new thing. Well, it's not really new, but it's sort of been coined as new, the free online access to medical education, which is something that was started by, I think it was Doug Cadogan of Life in the Fast Lane. He's an ER physician. And a lot of physicians and paramedics have really jumped on board the Foam Ed bandwagon. And one way to get access to the latest cutting edge news in emergency medicine in general is to go on Twitter and follow the hashtag FOAMED. And it's a good way for students to, you know, learn things new, ask questions. And the last thing I wanted to say, nothing to do with social media, but back to the topic of digital literacy again, is I think it's important in every program that we give some students some guidance as to how to distinguish between what is a credible website and what is a non-credible website. So talk about the PubMeds and the Cochrane collaboratives and the best evidence medicine sites, and talk about those, you know, primary research versus secondary research, and you know, what is a meta-analysis and those kinds of things, and how do you get access to all this really great information online, which is credible.
Clark, how about another question for us?
Okay. This one comes from a conversation I had recently with another EMS instructor, and it's in reference to simulation. If a new instructor is looking to utilize simulation within their classroom, but they lack the best high-fidelity equipment, how can they still actively use that and reach their goal?
I'm not sure they can if they don't have a high-fidelity simulator. But on a side note, I think if you're teaching a theory class, lab is a different story, but if you're teaching a theory class, I think it's important to bring manipulatives in the classroom, and sometimes that means bringing mannequins in and all kinds of equipment to demonstrate what it is you're talking about. I think that's very powerful in the classroom. If you don't have high-fidelity simulators, you know, I think you can get pretty inventive with some medium fidelity simulators. I'm trying to remember the name of the fellow who gave a great presentation on setting up vomiting mannequins and trauma mannequins, and at one of the NAMSI conferences, the one in Chicago, I believe. Because there's some pretty, and I think we may have talked about it on one of our previous episodes, but there's some pretty innovative things you can do with the not so high fidelity mannequins. But yeah, Bill, this is kind of in your wheelhouse.
And I'm going to take a different approach to it. And I think that the principles of simulation are not whether you have a $250,000 mannequin, but do you have clear objectives of what you want the student to learn with this simulation? And a simulation can be done with a simple task manager. Do you want them to establish vascular access? And you could have a simple IV arm and an IO and the tools to do it, and then a simple little vignette or scenario. And the other thing I think that's equally as important is I think it's okay to begin almost the very first day of class with scenarios or simulations with the students, with the idea that they will you keep it simple at the beginning, and you only begin to make it complex as they gain more and more knowledge within the classroom, so that way they're comfortable with their abilities to do it. But again, it still needs to be very much goal-driven. And I think that's the thing that you're going to want to make sure that you know exactly what it is you want them to get out of this out of this simulation that you're doing. So we actually have found that we do, and we do continuing education predominantly, we do use a high-fidelity mannequin. We borrow it from the local community college. But by the time we set it up, brief the candidate, the team that's going to come in and do it, do the simulation, then do the debrief, we might get two people through a scenario where we have found by using simpler, very focused, simple task trainers, such as just a chest compression mannequin that you can defibrillate, we can actually develop and choreograph very well the principles of initial resuscitation we want to do. Say, let's say, for the first 6 minutes of a resuscitation or the first 10 minutes. And we can get a lot more people through that. Matter of fact, almost all the students, and still have time to cover other topic areas. So don't get hung up on the sophistication. And remember, one of the most sophisticated mannequins you can have is a program patient. You know, getting going, if you got a community college or a college, go to your drama department and recruit students from there and tell them how they should act, some simple moulage, and voila, they're doing a high-fidelity simulation with something that actually bleeds and does all sorts of stuff. So don't get hung up on the sophisticated mannequins.
Good advice, good advice. How do you guys handle video recording? Do you do anything with that with your simulation? And then how would you do your debriefing?
Well, I could go first. When I've done video in the past of like students running simulations. I hasn't been with like high fidelity simulators, but more of the situation where Bill discussed, where you know some students are playing the role of rescuers and some as patients. And I've just used a handheld camera, and then I try to edit on the fly by just capturing interesting stuff going on, whether it be, you know, and related to whatever the objectives that we have. So if the simulation is really about just sort of capturing the basics of performing a patient assessment, and then I'll go after that. If we've been focusing on extrication, I'll try to turn the camera on and off when interesting things in extrication are happening. And then my style has always just been to let the video play. I don't get into a lot of sort of coach's clicker of like stop and pause and highlight, but just like let it play and let it speak for itself. And since it isn't sort of a nonstop continuous video, it kind of moves along. I haven't been totally clear. I've seen these products where you can have like four cameras running in your sim lab and it's capturing every second from every angle, like how that's useful, because you probably just end up with so much not really happening that you either waste a lot of time watching nothing or you have to do a lot of editing.
Yeah. You can use those one of two ways. We have about six ceiling mounted cameras in our lab, and we don't use them a lot, but one of the colleges down the road from us uses theirs quite extensively. And a couple of ways you can use that. You can use it very selectively. So, you know, maybe later towards the end of the program when students have a certain level of competence or proficiency, you can start to videotape scenarios and then use them, I think, as someone described earlier, for debriefing. The other place where that's valuable is when you're doing actual scenario testing and you can film it. And that way, if there's a disagreement between the instructor evaluation and the student's perception of what they did, there's a video for both parties to review to see if, in fact, the student did what they claim they did or the instructor missed something. So I think it's valuable in that too. The other benefit of filming in the classroom, number one, you got to get the students to sign a release form to allow that to happen. But the other benefit is, as a theory instructor, I can take those videos and play them in the classroom, and we can, you know, pause and discuss what went well, what's an area that could have been improved, and that's pretty powerful because that's a visual. And I can take, for example, best cased film scenarios from past years and play them for new students and say, you know, here is an exceptionally well run cardiac arrest, here is a really well managed patient in status epilepticus, and so on. So I think there's a lot of benefit there.
And I want to add in that it's important that you have a policy to students about how the videos would be used, and also, as Rob says, the releases. And I would do the same releases for still photography, particularly if you end up using it in any kind of school advertisement or anything. You know, they need to know that their images could end up being used in those kinds of cases. And that if you end up, again, also using videos as part of a way to measure competency, you know, like a final assessment or stuff like that, you should clearly have a scoring sheet that's used before you actually have the evaluator watch it or something along those lines there. Again, it's a great tool, and if you're using it in simulation, there is some software stuff that's very, very, very nice where you can record it and you can actually mark an event. So there's a way for you, if there were six critical things you wanted people to see when you were doing the debrief, there's a way to quickly skip to those things. But again, it depends on how much money that you have versus what Greg represented at the beginning.
Well, that makes good sense. We've recently started to do a lot more of recording. Our lab itself has four high definition cameras that are mounted in it, but because of the size of the recording, it's almost impossible to use it directly after a scenario for a debriefing. But we started using just a very inexpensive digital camera and just skipping to the highlights, starting recording, stopping recordings, and things like that. I've also found that it's really kind of gets the student to take the scenario a little bit more seriously. They seem to do a little better when they know that they're being watched and then going to be reviewed by their peers. When we review it, I try to say nothing. I also try to keep the people who are in the scenario from saying anything as well, because it seems to be they seem to always to defend their mistakes. And by having everyone be silent except those who were watching the peanut gallery, I think the students seem to get quite a bit out of it.
Yeah, that's a good point. I just wanted to mention there's an app that I've started using recently. It's an iOS app, and I don't know if it's available for Android or other operating devices, but it's called Coach's Eye, and it's made by TechSmith. And I don't remember the cost, but I think it's either free or pretty inexpensive. And you can play video in Coach's Eye, and then you can pause the video and draw on the screen, which is really powerful. You know, if you're doing driver training, for example, and you're teaching situational awareness, you can have a film of, you know, from the passenger side of an ambulance that's traveling along, and then pause it and say, you know, ask the students, are there any pedestrians that you can see? And, they might point out, well, yeah, I see some feet underneath that car up ahead, and you can circle that. And it's really, really quite an amazing app.
I'm going to put this in the show notes, Rob, to make sure I'm looking at the same thing. But that sounds like a really neat way that you're adapting something that wasn't intended for EMS education to use it for EMS education. Mm-hmm. And it might cause full-on mutiny from my son, who I'm always providing critique of his various sports, if I could say, oh, not only that, but look at this video. I will now scan out for you how you're pass there was off the mark. Yeah.
Well, if I can take anything sports related and turn it into a non-exercising endeavor, you know.
Hey, Clark, we're reaching the end here. I don't know if we've made it through your list of questions, but maybe pick one more for us.
Okay, this is kind of my last one. In your guys' opinion, how do you feel like the actions of new EMS educators or the EMS educators of today are going to impact the EMS profession as a whole in the future?
If I can start on this, I would say significantly. And I think that it's critically important that new educators take the role of educating seriously. And in other words, what I mean is, you know, go out and take, do instructor training or do a program in adult education, so you have a good sense of what education really means. Because I think people sometimes come into the industry thinking it's all about lecturing and sharing stories and being entertaining in the front of the room. And it's really not about that. It's about conveying information in a deconstructed way, being able to take what we do every day and break it down, drill it down with the students, have the students spending as much time thinking, talking, doing as we spend time speaking, so that they're actively learning. And I think that doesn't come to people intuitively unless they've done some formal training in that area. So that would be my advice to all new educators. And take advantage of your peers, your colleagues, your other educators. And I think Bill said this earlier, you know, watch other people teach, learn from their techniques and use that peer-based group to learn from.
Yeah, I like everything that Rob said, and if I was to add to that, if I'm a firm believer in Toastmasters as a way to develop your presentation skills, and Toastmasters is a speaking club that will help, I think, a great deal, particularly for the new instructor who needs confidence building. But even the seasoned instructor, I found it very valuable after even being an instructor for 15 years, going and getting what's called the competent Toastmaster, which is their first entry-level stuff. It really polished up a lot of my presentation stuff, and I thought that that was very worthwhile. And I do think that the thing that's going to influence the future is EMS educators today, but we have to raise the education standards and expectations here in the United States of EMS educators. I think at the very bare minimum, whether it's an EMT or a paramedic level program, a bachelor's degree, preferably in education or a science background, I think would prepare someone better to teach a lot of the science type material or have been exposed to that. I think that is a minimum that we need to get established. I think the days of people only having a GED or a high school diploma and being certified at the EMT level and being able to turn around and take a week-long state instructor IC class and then turn around and suddenly become the subject matter expert, it's wrong. But I also want to make sure that you understand, I believe there is a difference between someone who is a good administrator of a program versus the person that is actually trying to conduct the class, whether it be the clinical lectures up front, the lab sessions, or even the clinical experiences in the hospital or the ambulance. And I do think we need to raise the educational standards, and we need to follow the models of other healthcare professions that have done a great deal to improve their standing. And I absolutely support that accreditation of paramedic programs. I wish there was a way for us to accredit at all levels of EMS education.
I have just a quick thought on this question as well, and this has been a really neat conversation, and I think EMS is changing really fast, or about to start changing really fast. And one of the things that struck me recently is MedStar in Fort Worth, a very large EMS provider, recently changed their name from MedStar EMS to MedStar Mobile Healthcare, really recognizing that very little of what they do is emergency medical, but a lot of what they do is providing out of hospital or mobile or moving or bringing healthcare to the patient. And I think that's just a fascinating transformation. And for educators, I think there's just more than ever importance of being aware of like how the industry is changing quickly around us. And frankly, it's more than any one person can keep up with. So just trying to stay connected, not only to the academic research, like Bill encouraged and that sort of reading, but just sort of the popular press, if you will, that's related to the industry is real important for educators, because it will impact what they communicate to students about what this job actually involves of being a paramedic.
I was going to add, just kind of one last pearl, and that's for new educators, and that is to treat your students like their peers, not like they're, you're like we're up one level and they're down at another level, because, I teach a 2-year program, and at the end of 2 years, they're going to be doing shifts with me, some of them. So, and I find, being collegial with students and treating them like peers really helps them kind of blossom as students, because they really appreciate that respect.
Yeah, I wonder if that just lit up a whole bunch of listeners about that idea of that. And we might have to save that for the next show, Rob, but because I could certainly offer up some counterpoints, but I think the key isn't necessarily being peers, but being collegial and respectful and caring. I think there's there's still got to be some sort of like acknowledgement of, yes, I'm in charge of this.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Sure. And I think there has to be some dividing lines between your professional connection and your social connection, that sort of thing. Like getting back to digital literacy and social media, you know, we don't have a college-wide policy, but my personal policy is I don't friend my students on Facebook until after they've graduated. But in terms of, you know, my interaction with them, yeah, clearly, you know, I have this amount of experience and they're new, but you know, there's a certain, and sometimes it's not even what you say, it's just your demeanor and the way you your nonverbal communication with students that demonstrates your respect and your collegiality, and that makes a big difference, I think, in making them feel comfortable entering this new profession.
Well, Clark, how have we done for you tonight?
Good, very good. I feel like I've got some good pieces of some good gold nuggets of information to take back and to try to get into some practice here.
Well, and even better, you can go back and listen to the episode again, right? You didn't have to take copious notes because it will be
exactly
right there in your headphones once we post it. And I should mention that Ryan asked some questions on a Facebook page, much of which I feel like Ryan got covered in the questions that Clark asked, especially about teaching, maybe what are considered dry ideas or some of the social media and multi-generational. So thanks for posting that there. We like to wrap up with the recommendations or links, apps, resources. Listeners, remember, if you have something that you want to recommend and have us include in an upcoming show, just go write it on the wall at facebook.com/EMSEducast, and we'll check it out and see if we can't work it into an upcoming show. Rob, do you have something to kick us off with?
Yeah, you know, my recommendation might sound a little narcissistic, but for the last couple of days, in two separate classes, I played one of our past podcasts, podcast number 72 with Marty Johnson, about excited delirium.
Oh, wow.
And the charges he faced. And I don't want to give away too much detail because I want this to be a little teaser for people who perhaps haven't listened to episode 72. But I tell you, you know, that was, we've had so many interesting guests and we've had so many interesting topics, but that topic has so many pearls in it about not just the topic of excited delirium, but the medical legal aspects and what happens if you're involved in a negligent suit or you're charged with assault or some other criminal activity. How do you defend yourself? How do you prepare for that? What might you expect? It's a really, really fantastic podcast, and it generated a lot of good discussion with both my primary care paramedic students and advanced care paramedic students over the past couple of days. So that would be my recommendation to listeners. If you haven't heard episode 72, or it's been a while since you've listened to it, and if you're an educator, it's a great podcast to play in the classroom to generate some great, great discussion about the medical aspect, the physiology, tasers, medical legal. It's just packed full of pearls.
Well, it's awesome they bring that up because, you know, I've been mentioning throughout this show past episodes, and that was one I had up in an open browser tab thinking, how do I work episode 72 into this conversation? Because I keep mentioning to the listeners great ones from the archive. So that will be in the show notes, links to all the past episodes we've mentioned. As long as I'm talking, I'll go next. A friend of the show, Brian Lilly at Taney County Ambulance District in Missouri, he's been making a few videos for training for his service, and they've got a YouTube channel, and they posted a cardiocerebral resuscitation pit crew demonstration where it's a patient on the floor, and then people come in sequentially and demonstrate, actually work this. It's 7.5 minutes of the pit crew concept. And I really want to commend Brian and Taney County for, you know, not only adopting the pit crew concept, but putting a demonstration online as an internal training tool as well as external. I've received many people saying, where can I find some videos about pit crew? I just need something I can show people so they understand this. Well, Taney County's made an attempt at this. I think they've done a good job. And I continue to encourage educators. YouTube's full of great stuff, but there's a real lack of great EMS training on YouTube, and let's keep adding and increasing what's there. So I'll put that link in the show notes. Bill, you've got a great recommendation that I know you're eager to share.
Yeah, I wish I could take full credit for it, but I can't do that. But I can tell you that the Resuscitation Academy, which I had a chance to go to almost 2 years ago now, is offering a free download for your iPad and with iBooks or your computer with iTunes, and it's called 10 Steps for Improving Survival from Sudden Cardiac Arrest by Mickey Eisenberg. And it's available free from the iTunes stores, and I know we're going to have a link in it. And again, I'm just helping spread the word about this. It's just an excellent resource, and particularly if you're really interested in improving not just the care of patients you resuscitate in the out-of-hospital environment, but I do believe, as Dr. Eisenberg talks about, your ability for your organization to effectively and efficiently manage cardiac arrest can be a surrogate for how your organization as a whole takes care of all their patients. So I strongly encourage it.
Thanks for that find. I've downloaded that book earlier today. I was like, I got to get this before they change their minds and start charging people for it or something like that. I looked and I couldn't find it for the Kindle, so let's hope that maybe they add that real soon. Clark, how about you? You got a recommendation, something you want to share with other EMS educators?
Yeah, one of the things that we've been looking at recently for our ACLS pals and paramedic program was to try to incorporate the use of the iPad for an EKG monitor. And we found a really cool app. It was only about $10 for the basic app, and it's an entire cardiac monitor. For additional fee, you can also get 12 leads that will show for each rhythm you have, and then also chest x-rays for some of the respiratory folks. It's called ECG Rhythm and Monitor Simulator. It's on the iTunes store. You can find it there. It's by Star CPR from San Diego. Really cool app that we've used quite a bit with our recent paramedic students. We were able to plug it into through the VGA cable and display it on the overhead projector. And it's also an inexpensive way of creating a couple extra cardiac monitors.
Hey. What I love about mobile technology is I'm downloading that app right now as we speak on my iPad.
It's great. It really is cool. It's got everything from capnography to, you name it, it's got it on there.
Can you put the link in the Skype chat or in the send me an email? I think I found it, but I just want to make sure I'm looking at the right one. So, well, that sounds like a great recommendation. I haven't heard of that one, and our resident app expert Rob maybe hadn't even heard of it either. So thanks for their recommendation. Really appreciate that. Clark, this has been a lot of fun, at least for me. I hope listeners, you've enjoyed this. I think this would be a fun thing to do again. So whether it be Clark coming up with another list of questions or listeners, somebody else maybe wants to take over the microphone and ask the questions. I want to mention that on a related note, in the weeks to come, many times Bill has said, oh, we should just do an episode about airway education. And so I've put on a calendar, I think in late April, that we're going to do an episode just related to airway education. We're really going to dig into Bill's knowledge and experience there as one of his primary job responsibilities. So if you have questions that you want to make sure Bill answers during that episode, send them our way so we can include them. Thanks again, Clark. It's been real fun having you.
Hey, thanks, guys. I appreciate it. I'm glad to be part of this and to get some good questions out there for you. You guys had some great answers.
Well, thank you, everyone. Remember to connect with us at facebook.com/EMSEducast. Find all past episodes on iTunes, ProMed Network, and EMSEducast.com.